being our own people, received his first inkling of what came to be known as the Urbana Plan. McClellan had never enjoyed the notion of a head-on tangle with Johnston on those plains where McDowell had gone down. Some day, given the odds, he might chance it. That was what he was building toward. But to attempt it while outnumbered, as he believed his army was, seemed to him downright folly. Then Buell's refusal to advance against and through Knoxville, which would have placed his army on Johnston's flank, in a position to cooperate with the Army of the Potomac, caused McClellan to abandon all intentions of a due south attack, present or future. Poring over headquarters maps, he had evolved another plan of campaign, one, moreover, enlisting the assistance of the Navy, flushed with its three recent victories. He would load his soldiers aboard transports, steam down the Potomac into Chesapeake Bay, then south along the coast to the mouth of the Rappahannock, and up that river a short distance to Urbana, a landing on the southern bank less than 50 airline miles from Richmond, his objective. Without the loss of a man, he would have cut his marching distance in half, and he would be in the rear of Johnston, who then would be forced to retreat and fight on grounds of McClellan's choosing. The more he thought about it, the better he liked it. It was not only beautifully simple, it was beautifully bloodless. In the flush of first conception, he planned to set out immediately. "I have no intention of putting the army into winter quarters," he declared. "I mean the campaign will be short, sharp, and decisive." But there were numerous details, including the assembling of transports for the 150,000 men he would take along, all of which had to be accomplished in great secrecy if Johnston was to be left holding the bag in northern Virginia. It was enough to overtax the energies of even so expert an organizer as McClellan. Presently he realized that it would probably be spring before he could get the campaign underway. Regretfully, he wrote his wife, "I am doing all I can to get ready to move before winter sets in, but it now begins to look as if we were condemned to a winter of inactivity." "If it is so," he added, flinching from the protest he knew must follow, "the fault will not be mine. There will be that consolation for my conscience, even if the world at large never knows it." As if in confirmation, the rains came. The fields were turned to quagmires and the roads were axle-deep in mud. At last he had a reason for not advancing which even the politicians could understand. Then, late in the month, he had an even better personal reason. He came down with a cold, which the doctors presently diagnosed as typhoid fever, and was confined to his bed for 3 weeks into the new year. His good friend Stanton, legal light of the War Department, came to his bedside, peering over his spectacles and murmuring, "They are counting on your death and already are dividing among themselves your military goods and chattels." But when the president called, doing so for the first time since the snub McClellan had given him 6 weeks back, he was denied admittance. Lincoln was profoundly troubled. Not only was the general sick, but so was his chief of staff, Brigadier General R.B. Marcy, who was also his father-in-law. Subordinates might be able to administer the Army of the Potomac, which obviously was not going into action anyhow. But Lincoln wondered what was happening elsewhere, especially in the West, now that the guiding hand was paralyzed. On the last day of the year, he telegraphed Buell and Halleck, asking if they were acting by mutual arrangement. Buell replied that there were no provisions for concerted action. Halleck replied that he knew nothing of Buell's plans and that he was unable to cooperate in any case. "It is exceedingly discouraging, as everywhere else nothing can be done," Lincoln wrote on the back of Halleck's letter, and wired for them to get in touch at once. That same day he went to the office of Quartermaster General M.C. Meigs. "General, what shall I do?" he groaned. "The people are impatient. Chase has no money and tells me he can raise no more. The general of the army has typhoid fever. The bottom is out of the tub. What shall I do?" The question was rhetorical. Lincoln already knew what to do, and even how to do it. Midnight study of strategy texts, plus native common sense and conversation with professionals, had increased his understanding of the military problem. In language that was knotty and over-punctuated, showing thereby the extent to which he had labored to evolve it, He said in a letter to Buell at the time, "I state my general idea of this war to be that we have greater numbers, and the enemy has the greater facility of concentrating forces upon points of collision, that we must fail unless we can find some way of making our advantage an overmatch of his, and that this can be done by menacing him with superior forces at different points at the same time, so that we can safely attack one or both if he makes no change, and if he weakens one to strengthen the other, forbear to attack the strengthened one, but seize and hold the weakened one, gaining so much." However, the fact that he knew what to do and could state it thus in one hard-breathing sentence, the awful hug of the anaconda becoming more awful still as it shifted its coils to exert more pressure where the bones would crack, only rendered more exasperating the fact that nothing could be done. It was a question, Lincoln saw already, of finding the right man to do the job. Already he was looking for a general who would not only believe in his idea of this war, but would follow it inexorably to the end. Meanwhile, it was becoming increasingly evident that for all his gifts, for all his soldiers' love of him, McClellan was not the man. The bottom was not really out of the tub. That was only Lincoln's manner of speaking, designed perhaps to restore some measure of confidence when he got around to comparing the overstatement with the facts. He had known melancholy all his life, and this was one of his ways of working it off, just as sometimes, to clarify in his own mind a relationship with some individual, he would write the man a letter which he never intended to mail. Lincoln was his own psychiatrist. And yet the bottom had been almost out. Riding, or else tossed upon, the seethe and roil of popular opinion during the early weeks of what became known as the Trent Affair, public men on both sides of the ocean lost their heads, and England and the United States came closer to war than they had ever come without war following. Few doubted that it would come. Even fewer, apparently, did not welcome it in the heat of indignation, since in each case national honor seemed at stake. Mason and Slidell had left Havana while the guns of Port Royal and Belmont were booming out accompaniments for victory and repulse. Next day, November 8th, while DuPont's sailors occupied Fort Beauregard and Grant was counting noses back at Cairo, the Trent and the San Jacinto met in the Bahama Passage, then wore apart northward and northeastward over a glassy sea, the former having exchanged four passengers for a cargo of outrage explosive enough to blow the bottom out of any tub. In London on the 27th, the captain gave the authorities the news. Immediate and unrestrained, the reaction was in the nature of a shriek. Britannia had been touched where she was tender. "By Captain Wilkes, let the Yankee breed be judged," the Times declared, and stigmatized both him and it. "Swagger and ferocity, built on a foundation of vulgarity and cowardice. These are his characteristics, and these are the most prominent marks by which his countrymen, generally speaking, are known all over the world." Entering a cabinet meeting, the 80-year-old Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, flung his hat on the table and exploded, "You may stand for this, but damned if I will." Accordingly, while the cry for war went up all over England, an army of 8,000 boarded transports bound for Canada, where fortifications were ordered erected at strategic points along the border, and Royal Navy shipyards were thrown into a bustle of preparation beyond anything since the days when the first Napoleon was mustering all Europe for invasion. Lord John Russell was put to work drafting an ultimatum for presentation to the United States. Its terms were simple: either an abject apology, including surrender of the seized Confederate emissaries, or war. The Republic across the Atlantic had never been one to bow to ultimatums, least of all from its archenemy England, and especially not now, with its citizens engaged in a delirium of praise for the latest hero to twist the lion's tail. A week after taking his prisoners aboard, Captain Wilkes had put into Hampton Roads for coal. A tall, clean-shaven, regular, romantic in appearance, with becoming streaks of gray in his wavy hair. From there, having informed his superiors of his action, he steamed north again, bound for Boston in accordance with instructions to deliver the rebel envoys at Fort Warren, where a congratulatory telegram awaited him from the Secretary of the Navy. Your conduct in seizing these public enemies was marked by intelligence, ability, decision, and firmness, and has the emphatic approval of this department. The Army Secretary was no less enthusiastic. When the news reached the War Department, that dignitary led in the giving of three cheers by a group which included the Governor of Massachusetts. From the press, from the pulpit, from the public at large came praise for the captain's forthright action. Congress rushed through a resolution thanking him for his brave, adroit, and patriotic conduct in the arrest of the traitors, and voted a gold medal struck in his honor. He was wined and dined and paraded in Boston, and toasts to his boldness were drunk throughout the nation. For the administration to submit to an ultimatum and apologize for the captain's action would be to disavow that action and repudiate the hero before the eyes of his adoring public. With the nation already split in half and one tremendous conflict already building toward a climax, no one could say for certain what the result would be if the people were forced to choose between their captain hero and those who let him down. Thus, as in 1812, with the roles reversed, the two nations were poised for a war that would surely come unless one or both backed down, which was plainly impossible, believing as they did the worst of each other. On one side of the water, the British assumed that the impressment had been performed under government sanction, probably in accordance with instructions. On the other, the Americans, already provoked by the granting of belligerency status to the Confederacy, saw only another instance of England's avowing her intention to further the rebellion and assist in the dismemberment of a rival in the scramble for world trade. As if all this was not enough to make war seem inevitable, the British conception of what had fed the roots of the late outrage was reinforced by the aggressive diplomacy, the announced intention even, of the American Secretary of State, who was known to favor war with England as a means of reuniting his divided countrymen. He had said so repeatedly in interviews, in correspondence, and in after-dinner talk. If the North became embroiled with a foreign power, Seward believed, the South would drop its states' rights quarrel and hasten to close ranks against invasion, whereupon, with that war over, the two sections could sit down in a glow of mutual pride at having won it and reconcile past differences without the need or desire for further bloodshed. In this he was most likely much mistaken, for the main goal of Confederate diplomacy was to draw England into the conflict on the southern side. And yet he was not entirely wrong, at least so far as regarded human nature. Now that the hope seemed about to be fact, the reaction below the Potomac and the Ohio was not unmixed. Exultation was sobered there by the thought of Americans, under whatever flag, submitting to an old-world ultimatum. "As I read the northern newspapers, the blood rushes to my head," one diarist wrote. "In the words of the fine fiction writers, my cheek is mantling with shame. Anyhow," she went on to predict, "down they must go to old England, knuckle on their marrow bones, to keep her on their side, or barely neutral." Right or wrong, however, such was Seward's theory. A foreign war would still domestic strife. And now, as if by the bounty of fate, without the slightest effort on his part, Captain Wilkes's action and England's reaction presented him with an all-out chance to test it. Lincoln himself had his doubts about this theory, not only in general but in particular as it applied to the case in point. He rather agreed with the Southern diarist that there would have to be some knuckling done. "I fear the traitors will prove to be white elephants," he remarked when he received word of the seizure of Mason and Slidell. Unfamiliar with diplomacy, he was feeling his way. When a learned visitor explained to him that his blockade declaration had naturally gained for the Confederacy the rights of a belligerent in all the courts of Europe, since a nation did not blockade its own ports, Lincoln replied, "Yes, that's a fact. I see the point now, but I don't know anything about the law of nations, and I thought it was all right. I'm a good enough lawyer in a Western law court, I suppose, but we don't practice the law of nations out there, and I supposed Seward knew all about it, and I left it to him." He left it to Seward, but he did not let him go unsupervised. It was as if Lincoln said to him, as he had said to Herndon back in Springfield, "Billy, you're too rampant." Seward was called Billy, too. Billy Bowlegs, his enemies dubbed him, a bandy-legged, untidy man with a great deal of personal charm behind the bristling eyebrows, the constant cigar, and the nose of a macaw. Mrs. Lincoln detested him outright. "He draws you around his little finger like a skein of thread," she warned her husband. But when other advisers urged that he drop the New Yorker from the cabinet, Lincoln said, "Seward knows that I am his master." Seward knew no such thing as yet, but he was learning. Though Lincoln liked him, enjoyed his stories, and respected his political astuteness, from Sumter on he watched him and rode herd on him, toning down his overseas dispatches, which in first draft rather demonstrated his theory that a war with Europe would solve the urgent problems here at home. It was characteristic of Seward that, having styled the coming civil war an irrepressible conflict, he met it when it came with various efforts to repress it. Sumter, at least, had taught him that Lincoln was more than a prairie bumpkin, for the secretary informed his wife in early June, "Executive skill and vigor are rare qualities. The president is the best of us, but," he felt obliged to add, "he needs constant and assiduous cooperation." The Trent affair removed this final residue of doubt and at the same time vindicated Lincoln's decision to keep Seward at his post, despite the clamor of his enemies and the trouble he had made. Now that the war he thought he wanted was his for the asking, or indeed for the not asking, Seward discovered, perhaps to his profound surprise, that he did not want it at all. He said so, in fact, as soon as the news arrived from Hampton Roads. In the cabinet, while all around them were wild-eyed with praise for the bold captain, only Seward and Montgomery Blair perceived that in turning his quarterdeck into a prize court, Wilkes had not only been rash, he had been wrong, and by his illegal action had exposed his country to embarrassment. As Lincoln put it, "We must stick to American principles concerning the rights of neutrals. We fought Great Britain, in 1812, for insisting by theory and practice on the right to do precisely what Wilkes has done." Seward agreed. "One war at a time," Lincoln cautioned, and Seward agreed again. However, these three alone, Lincoln and Seward and the practical-minded Blair, could not breast the popular current running full tilt against them. They must wait. In his December 1st message to Congress, the president left the affair unmentioned. "Mr. Lincoln forgot it," someone remarked in shocked surprise at his thus ignoring the burning question of the day. The words were passed along, laughter being added to amazement. "Mr. Lincoln forgot it." And then, perceptibly, whether because of the chilling effect of the laughter or because, as in certain diseases, the fever itself had cured the fit, the excitement ebbed. Cooler heads took over on both sides of the Atlantic. The British began to consider that Captain Wilkes might have acted without orders from his government, and responsible Americans began to see that the Confederate envoys locked up in Fort Warren, where Slidell was being given his chance to conspire with the mice against the cat, and Mason was abiding by his oath, though in a manner not intended, never to visit that shore again except as an ambassador, were accomplishing more toward the fulfillment of their diplomatic mission than they would be doing if they had continued on their way to Europe. The first official show of reason came from England. Prince Albert, closeted with the Queen in his last illness, he would be dead before the year was out, toned down Russell's ultimatum, modifying its phraseology until the demand for an apology became, in effect, a request for an explanation, so that, instead of finding it dictatorial or menacing, as he had feared, Seward could pronounce it courteous and friendly. It was still an ultimatum, requiring an apology for the insult to the British flag, as well as the surrender of the envoys, but at least it opened the door for a reply in the form of something except a declaration of war. That was much. As for the apology, the one thing Seward could not give, verbal additions to the message indicated that a statement to the effect that Wilkes had acted without instructions would render it superfluous, since a nation could hardly be expected to apologize for something it had not done. Seward already had in mind the terms of his reply, but before it could be sent, he would have to win the approval of the rest of the cabinet. In the present state of public furor, with even Lincoln feeling that surrender of the captives was a pretty bitter pill to swallow, nothing less than unanimous action would suffice. For 2 days, Seward remained shut away in his office, composing a reply to the British demand. A reply intended not only for the eyes of the minister to whom it was addressed, but also for those of the American man in the street, whose sensibilities were the ones considered most in this explanation of his government's being willing to give up the rebel envoys. So that, though in form and style the document was brilliantly legal, showing Seward at his sparkling best, this was one State Department dispatch Lincoln did not need to doctor. It was not so much designed to stand up under analysis by the Admiralty law lords as it was to show the writer's countrymen that their leaders were by no means trembling at the roar of the British lion. Having complied with the basic demands of the ultimatum by 1, admitting that Wilkes had acted without orders, and 2, offering to deliver the captives whenever and wherever they were wanted, Seward then wrote for his countrymen's eyes, with reasoning that was somewhat specious, and language that was at times impertinent, what amounted to an indictment of the British point of view, past and present. In other words, under cover of an apology, he gave the lion's tail a final twist. Down on the Virginian Peninsula that summer, though by the rules of warfare he could not confiscate private property unless it was being used against him, Ben Butler had justified the receiving of slaves into his lines on grounds that their labor for the enemy made them contraband of war. "I's contraband," they would say, smiling proudly as they crossed the Freedom Line, and Butler put them to work on his fortifications. Now Seward took a page from the Squint-Eyed General's book, affirming that the envoys and their secretaries were contraband, liable to seizure. Wilkes, therefore, had done right to stop the ship and then to board and search her. His error lay in his leniency, for he should have brought not only the rebel envoys, but also the Trent and all her cargo into port for judgment. In which case, Seward was sure, the ship and everything aboard her, including the 4 Confederates, would have become the lawful property of the United States. However, and here was where the impertinence came in, the secretary could appreciate his lordship's being taken aback, for in impressing passengers from a merchant vessel, Wilkes had followed a British, not an American, line of conduct. Seward saw the present ultimatum as an admission of past injuries inflicted by the Mistress of the Seas, and he congratulated Britannia on having come round to the point of view against which she had fought in 1812. She could in no other way so effectually disavow any such injury as we think she does, by assuming now as her own the ground upon which we then stood. Captain Wilkes had been mainly right, but the United States wanted no advantage gained by means of an action which was even partly wrong. Seward was frank to state, however, that if his nation's safety required it, he would still detain the captives, but the effectual check and waning proportions of the existing insurrection, as well as the comparative unimportance of the captured persons themselves, when dispassionately weighed, happily forbid me from resorting to that defense. The 4 persons in question are now held in military custody at Fort Warren in the state of Massachusetts. They will be cheerfully liberated. Your lordship will please indicate a time and place for receiving them. Doubtless Seward had enjoyed those 2 days he spent locked away in his office, verbally building a straw man straw by straw, then verbally demolishing him handful by handful. When he emerged, however, prepared to receive the applause of his fellow cabinet members, he received instead cold looks and hot objections. They could appreciate the brilliance of his performance, but it did not obscure the fact that they were being asked to yield, which most of them had sworn not to do. It took him, in fact, as long to win their endorsement of the document as he had spent composing it, and the latter 2 days were far more hectic than the former. Christmas morning the ministers assembled. When they adjourned that afternoon to spend what was left of the holiday with their families, there had been no agreement. What Lincoln called a pretty bitter pill was for the cabinet, one member said, downright gall and wormwood. The war was 1 year old that night, the anniversary of Anderson's removal of his 80-odd men from Moultrie to Fort Sumter. Next morning the ministers reassembled. The discussion was resumed. It went hard, being asked to go down on their marrow bones against all their oaths and boasts, with only Seward's flimsy curtain of paradox and impertinence to hide them from the public and each other. In the end, however, as one of them wrote, all yielded to the necessity and unanimously concurred. Mason and Slidell were handed over on New Year's Day to continue their roundabout journey, the latter being 20 days late for the appointment he had made with his wife when he told her on parting, "My dear, we shall meet in Paris in 60 days." The public reaction to the outcome of the crisis was considerably less violent than the cabinet members had feared. Though the anti-British press continued to fulminate, according to tradition, in general there was a sigh of relief at having to fight only one war at a time. When Captain Wilkes, still wearing his laurels, was sent about his business, to be supervised more closely in the future, the public did not even feel let down. Poker was not the national game for nothing. The people understood that their leaders had bowed not to the British, but to expediency. Only within one group was there despondency that the rebels had been freed. "Everybody here is satisfied with their surrender," Lincoln heard from a friend in Indiana, "except the secession sympathizers, who are wonderfully hurt at the idea that our national honor is tarnished." On this diplomatic note, which opened shrill, then broke into falsetto, the first year of the conflict reached a close. Politically and militarily speaking, its laurels belonged to those who had established a nation within its span and defended that establishment successfully in battle, meeting and turning back attacks against both flanks of their 1,000-mile frontier, and staving off an advance against the center. McClellan's gains in western Virginia and the Federal Navy's trident amphibious lunge did something to redress the defeats along Bull Run and Wilson's Creek, but when those checks were emphasized, east and west, by the rout at Ball's Bluff and the repulse at Belmont, there was a distinct public impression, north and south, at home and abroad, of failure by the Unionist government to deal with the Confederate bid for independence. One side called this bid a revolution, the other insisted that it was a rebellion. Whichever it was plainly a fact, and both sides saw clearly now that the contest between Northern power and Southern elan was not going to be the 90-day affair they had predicted at the outset. Realization that this was so had grown until it was unmistakable, at which point violent objections were sounded on both sides by the extremists who had been foremost in predicting that the conflict would be short and decisive. Southerners were all bluster and would not fight if their bluff was called, the abolitionists had declared, and when one fire-eater had offered to wipe up with his handkerchief all the blood that would be shed, a less squeamish colleague had backed him up by offering to drink it. Now that blood had dripped and flowed beyond their power to drink or wipe, they waxed bitterly accusative, north and south, against those who held the reins. Chagrined that the war they had done so much to bring about had been taken out of their hands when it arrived, the two groups still insisted that their prediction had turned out false only because their aims had been betrayed. It could still be rendered valid, they affirmed, provided the war was fought the way they wanted. Each favored an all-out invasion with fire and sword and the hangman's noose, and each blamed its leader for an obvious lack of vigor in his thinking and in his actions. "Jeff Davis is conceited, wrong-headed, wranglesome, obstinate, a traitor," Edmund Rhett declared. While back in Springfield, the Northern president's erstwhile law partner complained that Lincoln was attempting to squelch out this huge rebellion by pop guns filled with rose water. "You ought to hang somebody and get up a name for will or decision, for character," Herndon wrote, and added scornfully, "Let him hang some child or woman if he has not the courage to hang a man." Between these two extremes, while the anti-Davis and anti-Lincoln cliques were respectively consolidating their opposition and sharpening their barbs, the mass of men who would do the actual fighting and the women who would wait for them at home took what came with a general determination to measure up to what was expected of them. It was their good fortune, or else their misery, to belong to a generation in which every individual would be given a chance to discover and expose his worth, down to the final ounce of strength and nerve. For the most part, therefore, despite the clamor of extremists north and south of the new frontier, each side accepted its leader as a condition of the tournament, and counted itself fortunate to have the man it had and not the other. Seen from opposite banks of the Ohio and the Potomac, both seemed creatures fit for frightening children into quick obedience. On the one hand, there was Davis, ambitious as Lucifer, with his baleful eyes and bloodless mouth, cerebral and lizard cold, plotting malevolence into the small hours of the night. On the other, there was Lincoln, the original gorilla, with his shambling walk and sooty face, an ignorant rail splitter catapulted by long-shot politics into an office for which he had neither the experience nor the dignity required. What they seemed to each other was another matter. Lincoln had recognized his adversary's renowned capabilities from the start, but it was not until well after Sumter, if then, that Davis, like so many of the Northern president's own associates, including even his Secretary of State, began to understand that he was having to deal with an opponent not below but beyond the run of men. Their official attitude toward one another gave a certain advantage to the Southerner, since he could arraign his rival before the bar of world opinion, addressing him as a tyrant and exposing his duplicity, whereas Lincoln, by refusing to admit that there was any such thing as the Confederate States of America, was obliged to pretend that Davis, too, was non-existent. However, it was a knife that cut both ways. Lincoln was not only denied the chance to answer charges, he was also relieved of the necessity for replying to a man who wasn't there. Nor was that all. Constitutionally, the Illinois lawyer-politician was better equipped for accepting vilification than the Mississippi planter-statesman was for accepting what amounted to a cut, so that, in their personal duel, the advantages of a cloak of invisibility were cancelled, at least in part, by the reaction of the man who had to wear it. Davis wore it, in fact, like an involuntary hair shirt. Followed by the admiring glances of Richmond ladies in made-over bonnets and men in last year's winter suits, he continued to take his early morning and late evening constitutionals to and from the office, where he spent long hours on administrative details rather than on executive decisions. With the bottom gone out of the slave market and gold already selling at a premium of 50%, the croakers were saying that he expended his energies thus to keep from facing the larger issues. But that was to overlook the fact that, rightly or wrongly, those issues had been settled back in the spring when he committed himself and his nation to the defensive. Now he was pursuing a policy which a later Southern-born president would call watchful waiting, watching for another Northern offensive and waiting for European intervention. His task was to turn back the former and welcome the latter. In the light of Manassas, which set the battle pattern, and the Trent Affair, which strained British-U.S. relations even further, Davis considered both of these outcomes probable, either of which would validate for all time the existing fact of his country's independence. Waiting had already brought him much, and now that it seemed likely to bring more, he continued to watch and wait, going about his duties as he saw them. Such duties involved an occasional social function and the daily hour which he reserved for his children. Of these, there were now four, Mrs. Davis having borne in mid-December the child christened William Howell for her ailing father. They were Davis's chief relaxation, for much as he enjoyed the social amenities, particularly an intimate evening spent with a few close friends, he mostly denied himself that pleasure in these times. He would drop in during his wife's receptions, spend an hour exercising his remarkable memory for names and faces, then dutifully, his invariable charm and courtesy masking whatever boredom he felt, take a cup of tea before retiring to his study and the paperwork that awaited him as a result of his unwillingness to delegate authority. The lady guests might have their reservations about his wife. She was rather too intellectual for their taste. Pleasant, if not wholly genial, one Richmond matron called her. But the men, coming under the sway of those attractions which had drawn her husband 17 years and 5 children ago, Samuel, the first child, died in infancy, did not feel that the breadth of her mind obscured the charm of her person. All were agreed, however, as to the attractiveness of the husband and the dignity he brought to his high office. He was showing the strain, it was true, but that only served to emphasize the wonder at how well he bore up under it, after all. Whatever their opinion as to his policy in adopting a static defensive, they all agreed that as a figurehead for the ship of state, he could hardly be improved on. Ornamentally, Lincoln served less well, though in reply to complaints about his looks, his followers could repeat what had been pointed out already. We didn't get him for ballroom purposes. Even here, however, he was trying. At White House receptions, he stood in line and pumped the hands of callers, performing the duty, one witness observed, like a wood chopper at so much a cord. He was learning, too, though his big hands split through several pairs of kid gloves on such evenings. Now at least the gloves were white, not black as at the opera in New York 10 months before. He had most of the problems Davis had and some that Davis did not have. Office seekers still hemmed him in and placed a constant drain on his good humor. Finding him depressed one day, a friend asked in alarm, "What is the matter? Have you bad news from the army?" "No, it isn't the army," Lincoln said with a weary smile. "It is the post office in Brownsville, Missouri." Unlike his opponent, he had no fixed policy to refer to, not even the negative one of a static defensive, which, whatever its faults, at least had the virtue of offering a position from which to judge almost any combination of events. This lack gave him the flexibility which lay at the core of his greatness, but he had to purchase it dearly in midnight care and day-long fret. Without practical experience on which to base his decisions, he must improvise as he went along, like a doctor developing a cure in the midst of an epidemic. His advisers were competent men in the main, but they were fiercely divided in their counsels, so that to all his other tasks, Lincoln had added the role of mediator, placing himself as a buffer between factions, to absorb what he could of the violence they directed at each other. What with generals who balked and politicians who champed at the bit, it was no wonder if he sometimes voiced the wish that he were out of it, back home in Illinois. Asked how he enjoyed his office, he told of a tarred and feathered man out west who, as he was being ridden out of town on a rail, heard one among the crowd call to him, asking how he liked it high up there on his uncomfortable perch. "If it wasn't for the honor of the thing," the man replied, "I'd sooner walk." In Richmond and in Washington, 100 miles apart, the same distances lay between Fairview and Hodgenville, their birthplaces in Kentucky. Davis and Lincoln toiled their long hours, kept their vigils, and sought solutions to problems that were mostly the same but seemed quite different because they saw them in reverse, from opposite directions. All men were to be weighed in this time, and especially these two. At the far ends of the north-south road connecting the two capitals, they strained to see and understand each other, peering as if across a darkling plain. Soon now that 100 miles of Virginia with its glittering rivers and dusty turnpikes, its fields of grain and rolling pastures, the peace of generations soft upon it like the softness in the voices of its people, would be obscured by the swirl and bank of cannon smoke, stitched by the fitful stabs of muzzle flashes, until at last, lurid as the floor of hell itself, It would seem to have been made for war as deliberately as a chessboard was designed for chess. Even the place names on the map, which now were merely quaint, would take on the sound of crackling flame and distant thunder. The biblical, Indian, Anglo-Saxon names of hamlets and creeks and crossroads, for the most part unimportant in themselves until the day when the armies came together, as often by accident as on purpose, to give the scattered names a permanence and settle what manner of life the future generations were to lead. The road ran straight, a glory road with split-rail fences like firewood ready stacked for the two armies, and many men would travel it wearing Union blue or Confederate gray. Blood had been shed along it once and would be shed again. How many times? Neither Lincoln nor Davis knew, but they intended to find out, and soon. The year just passed had been in the nature of a prelude, whose close marked only the end of the beginning. Chapter 3. The Thing Gets Underway. Albert Sidney Johnston, the ranking Confederate general in the field, was charged with maintaining the integrity of a line that stretched westward more than 500 miles, from the barrens of eastern Kentucky, through the Bluegrass region, on across the Mississippi, and beyond the kaleidoscopic swirl of conflict in Missouri to Indian territory, where it ended like a desert stream as it trickled in dry sand. To accomplish the defense of this Western Europe-sized expanse, penetrated by rivers, floating enemy fleets, and menaced along its salient points by two federal armies, each one larger than his own, he had a distinguished reputation, a nobility of looks and character, a high-flown official title, General commanding the Western Department of the Army of the Confederate States of America, and all too little else. He was a big man, broad-shouldered and deep-chested, over 6 feet tall and just under 200 pounds in weight. His wavy dark brown hair, touched with such gray as became his 58 years, the Kentucky-born Texan gave at once an impression of strength and gentleness. No beard disguised his strong, regular features, but a heavy mustache offset somewhat the dominance of brow and width of jaw. Commanding in presence, grave in manner, he wore his dignity with natural charm and was not without the saving grace of humor. It was Johnston, for example, who remarked that there was too much tail to Fremont's kite. In the 35 years since his graduation from West Point, where Jefferson Davis, looking up to him from two classes below, as at Transylvania earlier, contracted a severe and lifelong case of hero worship, he had distinguished himself in a colorful career. Frontier officer, Texas revolutionist, and Secretary of War in Sam Houston's cabinet, gentleman farmer, Mexican War colonel, U.S. Army paymaster, and commander of the famed 2nd Cavalry, whose roster carried the names of 4 future full generals, including himself and R.E. Lee, 1 lieutenant general, and 3 major generals, all Confederate, as well as 2 of the leading Union major generals. Zachary Taylor was reported to have said that Johnston was the finest soldier he ever commanded, and Winfield Scott had called him a godsend to the army and to the country. While the national storm was heading up, he was a brevet brigadier in command of the Pacific Coast, with headquarters at Fort Alcatraz in San Francisco Bay. But when Texas seceded, he declined an offer of high rank in the Union Army, tendered his resignation, and led a group of 30 pro-Confederate officers and civilians eastward on horseback across the desert toward his adopted state, dodging Apaches and federal garrisons on the way. From Galveston, he came on to New Orleans, where he was greeted as if an additional army had flocked to the stars and bars. His route to Richmond, through a countryside still elated over the 6 weeks-old Manassas victory, was blazed with fluttering handkerchiefs and tossed hats, the news of his coming having preceded him all along the line. Davis was waiting, too, and handed him his lofty commission and the accompanying assignment to the far-flung Western Department. "I hoped and expected that I had others who would prove generals," the Southern leader afterwards declared. "But I knew I had one, and that was Sidney Johnston." Still later, he put it even stronger, calling him the greatest soldier, the ablest man, civil or military, Confederate or Federal, then living. This high opinion was shared by the people of the region where the general's orders took him. From Richmond to Nashville, as from New Orleans to Richmond, the journey was one continuous ovation. Yet now that the new year had come in, with its hangover from the heady wine of Manassas and Wilson's Creek, all that seemed far away and long ago, as if it had occurred in another era, a dream world even, divided from the present by an airtight door which slammed forever shut in mid-September when Johnston arrived and saw for himself, at unmistakable first hand, the magnitude of the task that lay before him, and the paucity of the means with which he was expected to accomplish it. Politically, the lines were already drawn. Kentucky and Missouri both had stars in the Confederate flag, though it was becoming increasingly clear that Lincoln had mostly won that fight, in spite of secessionist governors and Fremont. The problem now was military, and the line to be drawn lay not along the Ohio River, but along a zigzag course conforming to the mountains and rivers and railroads of Kentucky and the crazy quilt pattern of Missouri. Such a line would be difficult to defend at best, but with the force at his disposal, it was patently impossible. He had something under 50,000 men in all, scarcely amounting to more in effect than a 500-mile-long skirmish line, distributed about equally east and west of the big river that pierced his center. In the Trans-Mississippi, the snarled military situation was aggravated by the rivalry of Price and McCulloch, whose victories had not brought them into accord. Since to elevate one would mean the probable loss of the other, along with many followers, Johnston proposed that the Richmond authorities assign to the region a field commander who would rank them both. Eventually, this was done, and soon after the first of the year, Major General Earl Van Dorn, West Pointer and Mississippian, a man of considerable fire and reputation, took over the job of welding the two commands into one army. Meanwhile, on his way from Richmond, Johnston stopped off at the far eastern end of his line and ordered Brigadier General Felix Zollicoffer, a former newspaper editor and Tennessee congressman, to take his little army of recruits through Cumberland Gap in order to post them where they could guard the passes giving down upon Knoxville and the Virginia-Tennessee Railroad. Having provided thus for his flanks, Johnston looked to his center, the critical 150-mile sector extending roughly east-southeast from Columbus, Kentucky, to Nashville. Davis had empowered him to withdraw Polk from Columbus out of consideration for the state's political sensibilities, or to sustain the occupation. It was not a difficult decision. In fact, Johnston had already made it when he sent Zollicoffer forward. But now he did more. Finding Simon Buckner waiting for him in Nashville, the former head of the Kentucky State Guard was now a private citizen, offering the South his services, Johnston commissioned him a brigadier, assigned him several regiments, and set him in motion for Bowling Green, 60 miles to the north. Far from ordering Polk's withdrawal, the new department commander swung his central sector forward, gate-like, with Columbus as the hinge. The line now extended east-northeast, and within a week of his arrival he had thrown every available armed man northward across the Kentucky border to strengthen it. It badly needed strengthening. At the outset, Johnston had fewer than 20,000 troops to man the long line from the Mississippi to the mountains, 11,000 with Polk, 4,000 each with Buckner and Zollicoffer, backed up by a few scattered camps of recruits in Tennessee, some without any weapons at all. But when Johnston appealed for arms and men to the governors of Alabama and Georgia, both were prompt in refusal. "Our own coast is threatened," the former replied, while the latter, if less explanatory, was more emphatic. It is utterly impossible for me to comply with your request. Not all were so deaf to his pleas, however. More closely threatened, Tennessee cooperated better, putting 50 regiments into the field before the end of the year, and Kentucky volunteers continued to come in, some bringing their long rifles. 4 regiments arrived from Mississippi before that state was shut off from him by governmental notification that the area was not properly within the limits of his command. Not that Richmond was unmindful of the danger, it sent what it felt it could afford, including 4,650 Enfield rifles brought in by blockade runners, and transferred to the Army of Central Kentucky, so Johnston called it, several of the Confederacy's most distinguished brigadiers. Georgia-born William J. Hardee, 46, not only a West Pointer and one-time commandant of cadets, but also the author of Rifle and Light Infantry Tactics, formerly an academy text and now the official drill and tactics manual of both armies, brought his brigade from northeast Arkansas to Bowling Green, where he took over from Buckner and soon was promoted to Major General, as befitted his wider experience and his position as commander of the vital center. Gideon Pillow, who had measured swords with Grant at Belmont, also was shifted eastward to bolster the advance. He too ranked Buckner and for the present became second in command of the Army of the Center under Hardee. 3 prominent Kentuckians, all in their 40s, also were available for the defense of their state. The oldest was George B. Crittenden, 49, West Pointer and regular army man, son of the senator whose compromise efforts had staved off war for a decade. Commissioned a major general, he was sent to the Cumberland Mountains region, with headquarters at Knoxville. Lloyd Tillman, 45, was also a West Pointer and a veteran of the Mexican War, but he had left the army for a career in civil engineering. Johnston soon had him busy designing and building fortifications. The youngest of the 3, 40-year-old John C. Breckinridge, was also the most distinguished. Vice President under Buchanan, he had presided over the joint session of Congress which declared Abraham Lincoln elected president, the office for which Breckinridge himself had been runner-up in the Electoral College. Since then, he had been elected to the Senate, where his opposition to the administration's war policy resulted in an order for his arrest. When Buckner first got to Bowling Green, Breckinridge entered his lines as a fugitive. "To defend your birthright and mine," he told his fellow Kentuckians, "I exchange with proud satisfaction a term of 6 years in the Senate of the United States for the musket of a soldier." Rather than a musket, Johnston gave him a brigade, despite his lack of military training. In addition to these men of rank, all in the vigor of their prime, the army had 2 cavalrymen who had already contributed exploits to its legend, Captain John Hunt Morgan of Kentucky and Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest of Tennessee. Though the former had fought in the Mexican War as a youth and later commanded his hometown militia company, neither man had had a military education. The latter, in fact, a Memphis slave dealer and a Mississippi planter, had had little formal schooling of any kind. By the end of the year, however, both had shown an aptitude for war. Morgan, who was 36, took 13 of his troopers on a reconnaissance completely around Buell's army and returned with 33 prisoners. In his first fight, northeast of Bowling Green, the 40-year-old Forrest improvised a double envelopment, combined it with a frontal assault, classic maneuvers which he could not identify by name and of which he had most likely never heard, and scattered the survivors of a larger enemy force. Standing in the stirrups, swinging his sword and roaring, "Charge! Charge!" in a voice that rang like brass, the colonel personally accounted for 3 of the enemy officers, killing 2 and wounding 1. He shot the first, sabered the second, and dislocated the shoulder of a 3rd by knocking him off his horse. Ordinarily, infantrymen had small liking for any trooper, but these 2 lithe, violent 6-footers caught their fancy, and soldiers of all arms predicted brilliant futures for them both, if they lived, which seemed unlikely. Soon after New Year's, the final brigadier arrived from West Virginia at the head of his command. John B. Floyd had had 3 months in which to recover from the rain-dammed campaign under Lee in the Kanawha Valley, where he had been more successful against his Confederate rival, Henry Wise, than against the wily Rosecrans. Ranking Pillow, he now became second in command of the forces under Hardee north of Bowling Green, along the Green and Barren Rivers. Floyd's brigade completed the order of battle with which Johnston was expected to fend off Halleck and Buell, whose combined armies were about twice the size of his own. In the Trans-Mississippi, a weird collection of 20,000 regulars, militiamen, and Indian braves awaited the arrival of Van Dorn to take the offensive against a well-organized command of 30,000 Union troops. East of the river, though Johnston had managed to double the number defending Kentucky, the odds were even longer. Between Columbus and Cumberland Gap, just over 50,000 Confederates opposed just under 90,000 Federals. Thus, Polk on the left at Columbus had 17,000 men opposing Grant's 20,000 around Cairo. Hardee in the center at Bowling Green had 25,000 opposing Buell's 60,000 southwest of Louisville. Zollicoffer on the right had 4,000 in front of Cumberland Gap, opposing 8,000 under George Thomas north of Barberville. Thus, Johnston had drawn his line, badly outnumbered at the points of contact and in danger of being swamped by combinations. Fully aware of the risks he ran, he had no choice except to run them, making such use as he could of what he had and resorting to bluff whenever the danger seemed gravest, first at one point, then another. Also, a use had been found for Tillman, who, with 4,500 men, was stationed where geographical circumstances would give his engineering skill full scope. The geographic factors were two rivers, the Tennessee and the Cumberland, whose existence threatened catastrophe for Johnston. Running parallel and piercing as they did the critical center of his line, the two were like a double-barreled shotgun leveled at his heart. Despite the northern direction of their flow, they offered broad twin pathways of invasion for the steam-powered gunboats of the fleet which now controlled their mouths, 12 miles apart on the Ohio. Once into his rear, their paths diverged and they became separate threats, one deeper and the other more immediate, but both dire. Against its current, the Tennessee led down across both borders of the state whose name it bore, and then bent east and north like a rusty hook plunged into the vitals of the South, touching northeast Mississippi on its way to Muscle Shoals in Alabama, beyond which it swung north, past Chattanooga, and finally on toward Knoxville and its source. The Cumberland, on the other hand, turned eastward soon after it crossed the northern border of Tennessee to curve back into Kentucky, across the front of Cumberland Gap and into the mountains that gave it both its waters and its name. Though the penetration was shallower, the consequences of an invasion along this line were no less stern. For during its dip into Tennessee, the river ran past Clarksville and Nashville, the former being the site of the Cumberland Iron Works, second only to Richmond's Tredegar in output, and the latter, besides its importance as a manufacturing center, was the supply base for Johnston's entire army. Those who were there before him had proposed to meet this two-pronged threat by constructing a fort to guard each river, Fort Henry on the right bank of the Tennessee, and Fort Donelson on the left bank of the Cumberland. The first problem, in each case, had been location. Northward in Kentucky, the rivers converged briefly to within 3 miles of each other, which would have allowed the forts to be mutually supporting. But since this was during the period of bluegrass neutrality, the chosen sites were necessarily south of the border, where the rivers were 12 miles apart, the same distance as at their mouths, 50 miles downstream, north of the two bridges over which the railroad, running northeast out of Memphis, brought food and munitions for the army. Work on the forts lagged badly from the outset, with much argument among the engineers. Yet enough had been done by the time of Johnston's arrival to cause him to leave them where they were rather than change their location when he swung his long line outward, gate-like, with Bowling Green as the stop-post and Columbus as the hinge. Consequently, the gate was badly warped, swagged inward to include the forts, commanded now by Tillman, whom Johnston sent to strengthen and complete them. The concave swag of the Columbus-Bowling Green sector violated the military principle requiring a defending general to operate on an interior line, so that in shifting troops from point to point along the chord of the arc, he would be moving them a shorter distance than his opponent outside the arc would have to do. Between these salients, the case was reversed. It was Johnston who was outside the arc, with the greater distance to travel from point to point. However, the textbook disadvantage was offset by the presence of the railroad running along the rear of his line, by which means he could shuttle his troops back and forth with far greater speed than an opponent, lacking such rapid transportation within the arc, could hope to match, despite any difference in distance. What was more, railroad and battle line were mutually supporting. So long as the line was held, the road would continue its fast shifting of troops, and so long as the shuttle service went on, the line, presumably, could be held. The chink in the armor, Johnston knew, was where the railroad bridges spanned the rivers. Gunboats could reduce the trestles to kindling within 5 minutes of opening fire. They were only as safe as the forts downstream were strong, and that was why he kept urging Tillman to exert all possible effort to get them finished. Here as elsewhere, necessity being the mother of invention,